Hello and welcome to episode 6 of Less Talking and More Running, a podcast brought to you by Aycliffe Running Club. Now then, Paul, we've got some good news for our running club. Training's back up and running. Do you just want to tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, no problem. Obviously, England Athletics released its guidance for operating in a COVID world on the 17th of July. And we've been working quite hard over the last couple of weeks to make sure that we can secure some COVID secure environments which to undertake our training sessions. Some of the training sessions are probably going to look a little bit different to what we've done previously. We do have to obviously respect social distancing and such like. And there are certain facilities that we don't have access to at the current time. But we're looking at some innovative solutions and just ways to freshen up some of the sessions as well. So I'm looking forward to us getting back to it tomorrow night, and I'm hopeful we'll get a few people turning up.
Yes, I'm very much looking forward to that. I'll try and make my way down, but nothing's guaranteed because I'm actually starting to do some physio work for our local football club, but we'll get onto that a bit later. Now, I think it's my turn this week to do the iconic runners. Who am I? So I'll do the first clue now, second clue halfway through, and third clue at the end. So the first clue is, this runner has one silver Olympic medal and one world championship gold medal to their name on the track. Right.
You haven't given us to go on there, Corey. There's not much to go
exactly,
on there.
Exactly. Think about it. Just think about it. The second clue is a big giveaway, and the third one will just tie it all together. Now, moving on to today's topic, we're going to be talking about injury prevention, rehabilitation, and return to running, a topic that's very, very personal to me, as well as the people I've got in front of me. I've got Ryan Pearson and Andrew Cedric. I'll come to you first, Ryan. How are you doing? And can you just tell us a bit about your background and your job role?
Hello, Corey. Yeah, I'm good. Thank you very much. Thank you, first of all, for inviting me to discuss injury prevention tonight. Again, it's something that's quite kind of close to my personal interests. I think I followed a similar route to you, getting into physiotherapy. So I first completed a bachelor's in sports rehabilitation, did that down in Surrey Uni, and then went on to complete the master's in physio at Teesside Uni, and actually finished that in 2008. Since then, I've worked as a physio at North Tees in Hartlepool, NHS Trust, and outside of that, I've always kind of pursued roles in various levels of sport and different kind of sporting environments, from amateur athletes up to pros and up to sort of international athletes. Very lucky, because since sort of 2015, our trust partnered up with Durham University. And since then, I've been working sort of split between what's called the musculoskeletal clinic in our trust and at Maiden Castle in Durham, which is Durham University's sort of sporting campus. So I've been lucky to work part of the week with in multi-sport, really. So that's kind of what I would class my speciality as. It's not a specific sport in particular, but just multi-sport. That's me.
Cool. What international athletes have you worked with? Any big names at all?
Or local big names? Drop those names.
I'm pretty confident there's been no runners. Well, my kind of multi-sport journey started at the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow in 2014. So I was lucky to work with some of the kind of bigger names there. A friend of the family is Amy Tinkler, and actually she's a British gymnast, so I've been lucky to work with her when she was competing for some of the kind of Commonwealth and up to the Olympics. At Durham Uni, we have a number of sort of elite athletes. The big sort of clubs there, I guess, is the rugby and the rowing and hockey. And some of the hockey in particular are members of the GB squad. The keeper, Ollie, has just been selected for the GB squad, the senior men's GB squad, leading up to Tokyo next year. So I've been lucky to work with people like that. I don't think Ollie will mind me saying, but he had quite a big sort of shoulder dislocation a year ago, and I was kind of quite involved in his rehab with that. I worked at the European Games in Baku 2018. I worked at the Asian Games in Turkmenistan the year after that. It's difficult when you have to when you get put on the spot like that. But yeah, as you say, it's kind of multi-sport across the board. Yeah.
No, it's quite a CV there, Ryan. And Andrew, what about you? What, can you tell us a bit about your background?
Yes, good evening, everybody. My background is basically a lifetime of sport. I think I've always done sport. Can't remember not doing any sort of form of sport. Cycling mainly. Later sort of moved into triathlon. That kind of got me into what I'm sort of doing more now. I started coaching triathlon about 10 years ago. And then I decided to make the move and go self-employed and set up Triology. So that kind of stemmed from a bit of a interest in sort of biomechanics, cycling, that led me into the bike fitting profession, which I do now. I've also been a soft tissue therapist, although I don't do that as much now. Most of my time at the moment is taken up with bike fitting and basically running the shop. So other than that, I'm trying to sort of stay fit as everybody else is.
Just touching on the bike fitting there, Andrew, that's, yeah. I think I'm a very much novice cyclist, don't do any, so I don't know much about it, but bike fitting is very much essential to avoiding injuries, isn't it? Can you just tell us a bit more about the thinking that goes behind the bike fitting?
Yeah, so it's, I mean, we get a lot of people that come in who haven't got any injuries and are basically just looking to sort of, you know, double check their, what they're doing is correct. Well, I say correct, everybody's different. So there's no real one size fits all. Injury wise, yeah, it can prevent injuries in the long term if, you know, I mean, you see cyclists in all sorts of weird and wonderful positions when you're out on the road, and it can lead to overuse injuries. It's a very repetitive sort of biomechanical process. So, you know, being in the right sort of ranges with sort of knee angles, hip angles, back angles, that kind of thing, yeah, definitely pays off in the long term.
100%. Ryan, what do you think some of the main risk factors are runners sometimes need to like think about to avoid any injuries?
I think the big ones for me, so I think as we've discussed in the past, there's some sort of key big risk factors that you want to get right, and then there's some smaller ones which might give you some marginal gains at the end of it. But I think for me, the biggest thing is biggest risk factor for running is having a poor training load sort of management plan, and that's both kind of overtraining and putting yourself at risk of a overuse type injury, and also undertraining and actually not making yourself and your sort of musculoskeletal tissues robust enough to tolerate running and to tolerate your training plan. That's a big one. Another big one for me is not incorporating any warm-ups or cool-downs into your sessions. Warming up is obviously a big kind of preventative measure for sustaining any injuries in a session. And then a cool-down is actually, if you get a cool-down right, you're putting your body in the best kind of recovered position for the following session. There's actually a lot of evidence that suggests that cooling down is the best form of recovery. So it's better than ice baths. It's better than massage, K-tape, all these other things that are out there. You know, if you get your cool down right, you put yourself in the best kind of position for your next session. Nutrition's a big one for me. I'm not a nutritionist, but it's all about sort of calorie intake and matching. Make sure you're matching your calories to the energy that you're using. Again, not kind of taking on board so many calories that you, you know, you make yourself overweight, I guess, and that will put a lot more stress through your joints and your tissues, and that can cause problems. But obviously taking on enough calories so you've got enough energy for your training plan. Something that happens more in kind of more elite runners is that they don't kind of take enough calories on board because they want to maintain that sort of lean physique. And that can, that the body kind of uses its energy where it feels needed. So that amazingly sort of movement and physical activity takes precedent over bone health. It takes precedent over some other hormonal sort of systems, like, you know, women's health issues. So if you're not taking on enough calories, you're definitely susceptible to things like overuse injuries, certainly sort of stress reactions in bones, stress fractures. So that's a big one. Next on the list for me would be not doing any S&C, not doing any sort of strength and condition sessions. So aside from the running, you know, fitting some time in the week to build some muscle mass and actually make your muscles and joints robust enough to tolerate running. And that's, for me, a big one. You know, there's arguments in the research with S&C, but from my experience, I think that's really important.
Can I just ask, Ryan, when it comes to your S&C and things like that, what sort of, I mean, for a runner, I would be looking to, so is it those functional movement patterns that you do, like squats and sort of like things like that, that are all going to maybe mimic or replicate the running motion and strengthen it in that way? Would that be something you would advocate?
Yeah, massively. Like, absolutely agree. So those are all examples. Functional movements are all examples of compound exercises. So it's a compound exercise where you move multiple joints and multiple muscles at the same time, whereas a simple exercise where you might move one joint and one muscle group, you know, say if you're doing a biceps curl, you know, you're moving the elbow and you work on the biceps. Say you do a row, you know, you work in the biceps, but you also work in, you know, the rhomboids, the muscles around the scapula, your forearm, your wrist muscles. And when you do a compound exercise, as well as it being functional, so it's more kind of geared toward everyday movement. It's also, you know, there's research that suggests you're working a lot more of your hormonal system, so you're building a lot more kind of cortisol, or you're getting a lot more things like cortisol, growth hormone, testosterone, things like that that promote muscle growth. Compared to, so to make it a bit more simple, if you want to build your biceps, do a row rather than a bicep curl. You'll get more bang for your buck, basically. And that's totally right about the other things as well, squats, lunges, even things like Olympic lifting is getting kind of recommended now. So clean and snatch clean and jerk and snatch and things like that. Not that I do them, but there is research that kind of backs that up to do alongside your running program.
I've definitely had a few lecturers say about more bang for your buck. That's what it's all about. So, Andrew, have you got anything to add on in terms of risk factors and managing them?
I mean, preventative-wise, I'd agree with Ryan. For me, strength and conditioning is, like, pretty up there to the forefront. Constantly drilling into people who I see coming in for various things, you know, it's all about being functional, strong, and you know, supporting your body and the muscles and the movements that you're doing repetitively. It's constantly amazing me how many people don't actually have a strength and conditioning routine in their training plan. I think runners and cyclists in particular are probably the worst offenders for that. You'd probably just, you know, you'd be surprised how many people don't actually do that, especially in the club. I mean, it's in the tri club, we used to run regular strength conditioning sessions, and there was a regular group that used to come, but a lot of people, you know, whether they don't see the value in it or they just haven't got the time, it's one of those, if you make the time, it's definitely worthwhile.
Why do you think that is, Andrew? Why do you think runners and cyclists don't make time for strength and conditioning?
Pretty much, well, it's all about miles. It's all about getting the miles. You know, it's aerobic fitness is the key, you know, to most people's training, which, I mean, it should be, but the fundamental issue of sort of, you know, injuries usually stems from a weakness or an imbalance in the body somewhere, and that's pretty much, you know, down to the lack of strength and conditioning. A lot of sort of newbies, you know, just come into the game, they'll look at the sort of the more experienced runners and they'll think, well, you know, if they're doing that, I can just jump straight in and go at the same intensity. And I suppose even some of the more experienced runners and cyclists, you know, still have a little bit of an old school attitude towards, you know, it's all about the miles, getting miles in. You've only got to look at Strava. It's all about how many miles you've done and how many sessions you're doing.
I think in my experience, and I've been guilty of it in the past as well, you only ever think about it when you've got an injury.
Exactly.
And you go to see a physio, yeah, and they give you some exercises to do. I know when I had an Achilles problem at one point, my physio at the time diagnosed it as actually a weakness around my hips.
Yeah.
And all the exercises I were given were about the core, improving my core work and things like that. And of course, as soon as I was fit enough to run again and I was aware, that was it. All these exercises just went by the by. Yeah. And that was when I was a fairly new runner. So, you know, I do tend to think that it's very easy to think about these things when you need them. Yeah. But I must admit, I do like now a nice body weight workout routine. I've got that Richard Blagrave book, I think it is. Yeah. And a lot of what I do is around body weight work. So I was interested when Ryan was saying there about kind of like you're getting into the weights and the things like that. I just tend to work with body weight. So I don't know if anyone's got an opinion just on body weight stuff. So I'm talking about planking or, you know, climbers, things like
that. I think if you stick with your functional movement, so a lot of the research now was saying that, you know, I think kind of traditionally you might be under the impression that you've got to do lots of reps and lots of sets as a runner. So you want to kind of running is obviously an endurance sport, so you want to build up that tolerance to endurance, but actually it's the opposite. So you know, you're just adding more kind of load. So if you're doing lots of reps, you get your endurance out of running, you know, doing the actual run, and that's where you strengthen your endurance system and your aerobic system. But to build muscle and muscle to run, it's the opposite. So you should be lifting heavy weights and you should be doing low reps, low sets, because, well, for two reasons. So you're not further stressing the aerobic system, which you do when you're running anyway. So you're further making yourself vulnerable towards like an overuse problem. And then the other thing, it's heavy weight is said to improve movement economy, which is very important. As well. So, and loads of kind of, like I say, I'm not really a running physio, but, you know, I do like read and listen to podcasts and things by more running specific physios, and loads of them agree that it's all about kind of heavy weight, low sets, low reps for those reasons.
Interesting. Yeah, it's interesting that.
If whether you buy into it, I don't know, but, you know, you're obviously a very competent runner already, so. But you know, it's maybe not necessarily going to improve your performance, but it might help you with your injuries.
Yeah, just manage your, as I'm getting older, of course, I'm very conscious of the fact that I need to help support my running in other ways. I did take up cycling a bit last month, but then I fell off my bike, so I've not quite got back on that yet.
I'm a fan of sort of cycling in itself anyway, but I would always recommend it to runners as well as something to do to cross train and just to kind of, you know, keep stress off some joints and just mix it up a bit as well.
Yeah. No, great advice. Yeah.
Andrew, have you got anything to add on that in terms of bodyweight exercises?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of bodyweight stuff. Purely because it's, you know, it's easy to do. You can literally do it without any equipment. You can do it, you know, 5 or 10 minutes a day if you want to do just something nice and quick. I mean, like Ryan said, there's an argument for bigger weights, sort of lower reps, you know, pure sort of strength work. I've done a bit of that in the past as well. If you do it right, then it's really, really helpful. I think it's how you attack it, and people often get the wrong impression of what they need to be doing. I mean, there's two extremes. People can go into the gym and see people lifting real heavy weights with really bad form and technique and think that that's, you know, how to do it. You've just got to be sensible in what you do.
I totally agree with that. Like, that's a really good point. It's all well and good lifting heavy weights, but you've got to get it right, and you don't want to make that another factor that contributes towards injury either.
Yeah.
So I totally agree with that.
Interestingly, on this month, we've got an Oregon Circuits session. And I was listening to a podcast that was put out by, I think it was Mark Brace from England Athletics last month. And he was saying the first thing you do is you actually get the exercise right. So you need to get that, perfect your actual technique before then progressing it onto something else. So you need to get just the basic squat right before you then maybe move on to a pistol squat or a sumo squat or something along those lines. But he was drilling into us on the podcast that it is very much a question of you get your technique and you get your performance right first of all before you progress.
Yeah, totally. It's so easy just to fall into a bad habit and think you're doing something right when you can actually probably be doing yourself more harm than good. Yeah.
I just want to focus now on training load and what comes into it. So obviously we've talked about how we train and what and stuff we can do in terms of form and what we do in our training itself. But training load is something we need to manage to avoid obvious injuries like we all mentioned. I don't know if any of you have heard of the chronic acute training load ratio at all.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, chronic's over the last 4 week period, and acute is obviously the last week you've done. I can't remember the ratio off the top of my head. I should have really searched this beforehand. But basically, your acute training load the last week you should do should not exceed a certain percentage of your chronic training load you've done. So basically, avoid the sudden sharp spike, which can lead to an overuse injury. Do you think some runners tend to do that? Like Paul, you've mentioned, you've come back from an injury, boom, I'm going to get the miles back up to try and maybe play catch up for a race that I've got coming up.
It happens.
Yeah, totally. And it's understandable that it happens, but like you say, it's a massive risk. Because I'm a massive geek, I know which paper you're talking about. And the ratio is... It's 0.8 to 1.3. Tim Gabbett, basically, you know, to calculate your chronic training load, you multiply the minutes that you've trained in each session by your rate of perceived exertion for that session, and then you add those numbers up. So it might be a 20-minute session at 8 out of 10, so it becomes 160 training units of training load. So that would be one session. You add them up for the week. You then kind of add your previous 4 weeks together and divide by four to get an average. So that gives you your chronic training load. And then your acute your acute is basically what you're going to do in this upcoming week. And it should be between a factor of 0.8 and 1.3 of that calculation. So the research basically suggests, and it's done on team sports, so I'll kind of add that. So it's not done on runners, it's done on possibly rugby. I'm not sure, but it was a team sport environment. It was a team sport study. And basically, if you keep within that 0.8 to 1.3, it's known as the sweet spot. So you're not going to kind of, you know, overtrain so much that you cause tissues to break down. And yeah, you're totally right. Anything over that 1.3 is, you're massively ramping up the stress through your tissues and you're massively kind of increasing the risk of injury. On the other hand, if you go below 0.8, you're potentially undertraining and you're going to kind of cause problems there because you're not keeping yourself, strong enough to to tolerate ongoing training. So it's just about getting in that kind of range. So, you know, to add to that, you want to progress. You don't want to kind of keep your training load the same. You do want to increase it a little bit. So as long as you're not going above a factor of 1.3 each week, you know, you're gonna get stronger. But then around about every fourth week, you should have a deload week anyway. And that's something where you just let your kind of body catch up from that, like, cumulative stress that's gone through the system for the previous 4 weeks. But even that deload week, so it's not kind of resting completely, it's keeping the numbers around that 0.8. And I would, in the past, I've kind of given athletes Excel spreadsheets that work that out, so that they can, for each session, they just have to put in the minutes and the RPE, and the spreadsheet works out the training load for that week. And then it works out what you should be kind of factoring in for the upcoming week. And if it's looking like you're doing too much, then you can knock it down a bit. You can take a session out, or you can change an interval session into an easy run or something like that. And that's kind of a really good way of doing it. It is very geeky, I'll say that. And I think someone mentioned in one of your other podcasts about the function on Strava, is it relative load or relative effort function?
Yeah.
So if you monitor your training with a heart rate monitor, it works it out automatically. If you don't, you can just manually put in what your RPE or your rate of perceived exertion was, and you get a calculation that way. And I think it's not the same data as that, you know, it's not the same calculation as that study, but it looks pretty good to me. So if you want to kind of be mindful of that, that's a good thing to use, I would say.
Yeah. One thing that resonates there is that I know when I did my coaching qualification, they always talked about a 3 week steady progressive load, if you will. And then the fourth week was always a cutback week for recovery and adaptation. Yeah. And then you go again. So that certainly, you know, echoes what Ryan was saying there. And also, I think, I know you mentioned Strava there, but I think it's Training Peaks does something similar about working out your load. Because I could get an email every day telling me that, like, my threshold levels changed and things like this. I disregard it. I haven't really looked at it too much. But I know there are programs out there that will actually work it all out for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure about Training Peaks. Strava's the only one that I'm kind of really, really up on. I don't know if Andrew knows much about that.
Yeah, from a cycling point of view. Quite a bit. It's probably more biased towards like triathlon, multi-sport sort of athlete. A lot of it's based on power. So when you're cycling, using a power meter, gauge intensity and your training load. And it does take running and other sort of disciplines into factors as well. It's quite comprehensive.
I think it's time for clue number two of iconic runners. Who am I?
I remember. I wasn't good enough to go.
I remember. I've been wrong. Don't worry. I've got a timer in front of me. So the second clue is, in a 19-day period, this runner set the 1,500-meter, 2,000-meter, and a mile world record.
Yeah.
I think Paul's got it. Paul the geek. You could probably give me the exact... exact time frame, which year and month and all that happened. Can you remember the year?
I wouldn't know that.
All right. Okay.
But cool. I think I know who you're talking about.
Yes, it's Well, I was about to give another clue, but no, I'll hold that back. Andrew.
Yes.
With training load, we've also got to take into your work life management and other stress factors that come into play. Do you think when, say, someone's coming up with a training plan for themselves, or a coach is doing it for another athlete, they have to look at the athlete as, or a person as, the whole picture, not just what they've done or what they may be capable of in, like, their performance-based stuff. Maybe they've got to look at, like, the whole person as themselves.
Totally. I mean, I'm probably as guilty as most people out there who've even had training plans and not being able to stick to it for whatever reason. As long as you're honest with yourself, and if you've got a coach, if you're honest with them, then, you know, you've literally got to be honest with yourself. And if you're missing things, you know, if you're not doing the right intensity, if you're going over or under, you've just got to be really sort of realistic, I think. But yeah, everybody's lives are, you know, completely different, and we've all got different responsibilities and sort of time to sort of spend on things. It's just getting the balance right. It's being sort of consistent, I think, is the main thing.
I think from sort of like runners that I've worked with individually in the past, the first thing I get them to do is to fill in an athlete profile, but it covers everything off about family life, what time of the day they're best off training at, or what their work commitments are and things along those lines. And then we can sit there and have a very honest discussion about the time that they can commit to it, whether the goals are actually realistic for the time they can commit and things like that. But I think that, as you say, that honesty is the most important thing, I think, really, between any coach and any athlete.
It's really easy to please the coach with something that you really probably haven't done or not done as well.
Make some false promises as to what you're going to do. Or
but you're only kidding yourself. You just let yourself down.
Indeed.
Ryan, have you got anything to add on that? Maybe the best training plans are the ones that could be adapted because of what's going on. Say you're very tired from doing a couple of shifts back to back or something like that.
No, I totally agree with what Andrew said. You can get very bogged down with mileage and intensity, and when really there's lots more sort of stress you've got to, you know, you should really take into consideration in your life. Your work, like you say, work stresses, personal life, sleep, nutrition, all these other things add up to how much stress is going through your body. And really, you can get bogged down with all these factors, but then it's how you feel on the day. So, you know, the most easy way to do it is, like Andrew says, just be honest and say, yeah, I feel tired today. I've got a really kind of, my legs feel all right. And I've got this kind of, I've got this heavy session plan, but I didn't sleep very well last night, or I had a heavy shift. So definitely like modify your training because of that. Maybe still do something. I'd probably, my old mindset used to be, if I felt tired, I just wouldn't do anything because I couldn't train to the level that I wanted to. So I would just bin it. But I think if you feel tired and you've got a high intensity session plan, still do something, you know, but make it an easy session, just to like a recovery run or something like that. But yeah, just it's how you feel, isn't it?
Oh, 100%, yeah. Great. I think the listeners are going to have a lot of advice and knowledge gained from this podcast. I certainly have. I've mentioned stuff that I know, but I'm still learning. Still learning every day. As a runner, as a person, the experiences you come across and things like this, you learn, and hopefully your next training plan for your next race is going to be better because of this. Paul, have you got anything to ask?
I was just going to say, I know of several runners who, after maybe a hard session on a Thursday, for instance, might go out on a Friday morning and just do a shakeout run or something along those lines, just 2 or 3 miles, just very, very easy, just to sort of like turn the legs over. Do you think there's, excuse the pun, much mileage in that? I've been thinking about that all day, so I'm going to have it.
Yeah, I mean, why not? I mean, you've got to differentiate between what your sort of your sessions are. Make your hard sessions hard, make your easy sessions easy. A lot of people kind of blur the lines and just make everything one sort of intensity, or, you know, they'll go under or over. But yeah, it's a lot to be said for just, you know, taking things really easy after a hard session. Definitely, I do.
I think I read the other day, Eliud Kipchoge goes out and runs at 9:40 pace or something like that as his first run of the day or something like that. Does a few miles at 9:40 pace. I think, well, blimey heck, if he's doing that, I should be running at about 12-minute mile pace or even slower.
Is that the Kenyan shuffle? Is that the pace? Is that what it's called? The Kenyan shuffle,
yeah. I just have something else I was going to ask now, but it slipped my mind, so I'll let you come back in, Corey.
I was going to move on to recovery methods. So obviously, Ryan, you've mentioned how essential the cool down is, but a lot of runners also do other stuff on top of that, such as massage, the foam rolling, if they want to, the ice baths. I don't know if you've got anything to mention about that, guys, because a lot of runners seem to think that's quite a big bulk of the recovery, but really,
may not be. I mean, Ryan might have a different outlook on this than I do. Foam rolling is it's one of those magic wand things that people rave on about. It's really easy to get that one wrong if you're not careful. So I'd be careful with the foam roller. Ice baths as well, that's another sort of, I think that has now sort of not died a death, but the big sort of, it was all a rage at one point. And I think the science has probably kicked that into touch a little bit more. There's a lot of things that come up as in trends, and you've got to be careful as to what, who's saying what, and, is it actually relevant? I don't know. Ryan, what do you think?
No, I pretty much agree. So like I said before, the research from what I've read does suggest that your cool down is your best form of recovery out of everything that's out there. Don't skip the cool down. And a good piece of advice I think I gave someone, I didn't realise I gave them a good piece of advice, was to stop your Strava kind of when you finished your main session and then do your cool down as either a separate session or just don't record it. Because obviously, for these people that are kind of well into Strava, like the average speed's obviously very important.
Yeah, and if you write down that, I mean,
and then I think one person I spoke to it was a cyclist that was getting knee pain after his big rides, and he was quite a fast cyclist, and but he was quite a big Strava enthusiast, so it was all going on there. And his obviously average speed for cyclists is really important, and in their community. And I said, just stop Strava 5 minutes from home, get into a low gear and just, spin easy for the last 5 minutes. And if that's your cool down, that's your cool down. But don't cycle hard to your house and then stop and then switch off, have a shower, get food, and don't do any kind of physical cool down, because that's half of the problem with your knee pain, because your body won't have reset from that session when you're going out the next day. Or even the day after, it can last for 48 hours. After a high intensity session, it can last 48 hours. So you need to do a good cool down. Like I think all these other things, foam roll and ice baths, there's probably some value in them, but it's very small, and it's only there if you're doing these other things right. So yeah. If you are if you're running, if you're a high level runner. Or even like you guys that run 30 plus miles a week, and you're probably doing the warm ups and the cool downs, you're doing all that right already. But then you want to go out the next day and do and put your body through that stress again. So something else will probably help you guys. You need that extra. So there's nothing wrong with foam rolling. There's nothing wrong with ice baths. They do have benefits. One thing with ice baths is that you've got to condition your body to it. So again, there's been studies done that. If you don't do ice baths and then all of a sudden you want to use it as a recovery method, it can cause more harm than good. It can actually cause tissue damage to do it as a one-off. But if you do it, I can't remember, the study was done on Olympic swimmers or something, and they kind of built up their tolerance to the temperature over a number of weeks before the Olympics, and then it actually benefited their recovery. So it was keeping the keeping the temperature higher to begin with, and the minutes immersed kind of shorter, and then gradually increasing until they were up to like 10 minutes fully immersed at minus whatever degrees, and then that started to show benefits with recovery. So that's my thoughts on that. But
can I throw a potential Can I throw a potential controversial one here? Stretching, stretches. Ooh. Any views on stretching and stretches?
Yes. If you do it right and you're consistent with it, definitely beneficial. It's doing it right. A lot of people you see at the track warming up and, you know, they're not even warming and they're stretching. That's probably one of the worst things you can do is, you know, stretching core muscles, overstretching. A lot of people will overstretch. The stretch doesn't have to be, you know, a massive sort of range. It's just easing the body into what its normal range is, or just slightly beyond that. But it varies from person to person. Some people are just naturally flexible, some people aren't, so you've got to be careful with stretching. But better off doing it afterwards rather than before, I think.
Yeah, because there was always that big debate, I suppose, about static stretching and dynamic stretching a few years ago. So it's always a bit of a controversial subject, I think.
I think it's one that goes, it's kind of, it swings and roundabouts. Sometimes it's advised, sometimes it isn't. It's in and out. Certainly, I wouldn't do any type of stretches before. Before activity, I would just keep it dynamic. That's the best way to warm the body up, you know. Yeah, it's sort of also for performance as well as kind of injury risk. If you're you need some stiffness in your muscles and your joints to produce force. I did a little sort of injury screening session with some of the members of Ayrcliffe Tri Club, actually. Some of the guys that were doing an Ironman this year, or was going to do an Ironman before everything got cancelled. And one of them is super, super stiff, so he couldn't kind of get full depth in a squat. Andrew probably knows who I'm thinking, who I'm talking about, but he was absolutely, I'm not going to name drop. He probably wouldn't mind, but I won't. He just super stiff. It was laughable. And the thing is, he is an unbelievable runner, an unbelievable cyclist. Is the power transfer, I think, because of the stiffness, is unreal. So that's getting that balance right, isn't it? You know, making sure that you're flexible enough so that your body moves functionally, but you're not so flexible that you're losing that kind of power transfer.
Yeah.
My question's come back to me, Corey, that I was thinking of before. Are there any great myths that you can debunk? And I'm thinking about a conversation, I think, that was on our Facebook group a while ago about plantar fasciitis. No. And I must admit, I've always had relief from a golf ball, but I know Andrew had a different view, or very much probably came in with the professional view on it, I think. So are there any myths that readily come to mind that you can debunk about recovery or anything like that?
I think the particularly about plantar fasciitis or anything.
Any of those myths that you regularly hear, I think, more so. But if you have one, that's fine.
How long have you got?
Some examples.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the as mentioned before, the sort of strength and conditioning one about lifting kind of low weight for lots of reps. I think that's getting debunked a little bit, and it's all about lifting heavy for low reps and sets. Yeah, foam rolling, acupuncture, K-tape. might work for you guys, but, nothing's a no, but and sometimes a trial and error. But some of those things I mentioned don't have much evidence backing at all.
I tell you, as a physio I follow on social media who loves debunking all these myths, it's called, you might have heard of him, called Adam Meekins.
Yes, I've heard of him. Yeah,
he titles himself as the sports physio on social media. Might be worth, whoever's, if you listen to this, you might worth checking him out. Some people think he's quite controversial, but anything debunking myths, it's going to be controversial. That's just how it is. That's how it's always been. So it might be worth checking it out. Andrew, yeah. Have you got any myths to debunk?
The thing is with myths, it's what works for some people doesn't work for other people. It becomes a myth because those people have actually, it works for them. So they swear by it. There's things I've tried that haven't worked for me, and there's things that I do now that people probably wouldn't even think, that's a little bit odd. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, then, don't worry about it.
I think that's something I mentioned to Richard at the track on Saturday, actually, when we were doing a session about something. Sometimes it's all about the you were there as well, Corey. It's just sometimes it's all about the individual, and it's what works for the individual rather than maybe, I suppose, what works for the general, I guess.
Yeah.
Can I just say, those things I said as well, stretching, acupuncture, K-tape, I actually use all of those things. So, like Andrew said, there is value in them, but you're kind of, I don't use them often, I'll say that, but I do use them. So I'm not totally saying that there are like Andrew said, that different things work for different people. So
do you think there's some psychological value in them though, such as the K-tape?
I mean, that's a benefit in itself. If it's psychologically positive, then that's fine. That's great. I think, a good one for me was the compression wear sort of phase that happened, a few years ago. I think it's kind of died off a little bit more now.
Craft guards.
Yes. People still use them, swear by them. I've used them myself. And, I think it's one of those things. If it works for you, then it's great. But everybody's different.
Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. Obviously, and it's the way these things are marketed as well. Absolutely. I mean, pain is processed in the brain. So, another thing as well, you might have pain when you're running, but it might not actually be completely related to injury. There's different things that contribute towards pain. It's not just tissue damage. So, there's perception of pain, there's the chronicity of the problem. Lots of things contribute to pain. And so pain is therefore processed in the brain. So if you do something that you have a little bit of a belief in, it's worked for someone else, maybe. You've seen someone else with K-tape on. Someone's raved about acupuncture. And then you have it, that's probably going to take away some of that. Or, it's going to contribute towards taking away some of that psychological element of pain. So, yeah, massively.
Yeah. I've mentioned early on in the podcast, I've just started doing some physio and sports therapy work for a local football team. And I had the first game on Saturday with them. And a couple of players would be like, "Oh, can I get my ankle taped up and whatnot?" And I was thinking, in my head, I didn't say it to them, but in my head, I feel like it's a waste of my time. But if it gets them to play a 5% better, because in their head they feel more prepared for the game, then I'm going to do it, because that's what it's all about at the end of the day.
Magic spray, that's what it's all about with football.
Oh, yeah, the magic sponge as well.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with zinc oxide taping. So there's nothing wrong with K-taping, but actually there's lots more evidence towards zinc oxide taping. So footballers, if you're strapping someone's knee or ankle to get back following an injury, there is lots of evidence that supports the use of that. So you're not, it doesn't give much mechanical support, but it stimulates the nerves of in the skin and what's called the subcutaneous nerves, the nerves around the skin of that joint, so that joint moves more efficiently. And so there is research towards sort of K-tape and zinc oxide tape in that capacity. Mm. But the way K-tape is marketed is that it inhibits or facilitates muscle activity. And it doesn't, there's no kind of evidence that backs that, but that's how it's marketed. If you've got a weak muscle, it makes it work harder. If you've got a overactive muscle, it switches it off. But there's nothing that backs that. But there is research that says it does, just by having the presence of that tape around the joint or that kind of muscle area, it does increase what's called like proprioception and neuromuscular input and things like that. And it does make that muscle, that muscle or muscle group or joint work a little bit more efficiently.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, there is a place for it.
No, 100%. Yeah. I mean, we could probably go on forever, but I kind of want to tie nicely in the time we've done. We think we've done over 50 minutes already. I don't know, just you've probably prepared some stuff, guys, but I don't know if there's anything you really want to mention before I tie off the podcast. Any little nuggets of advice we haven't mentioned already?
I think we've ticked off pretty much everything there.
I would say...
I would say hydration
is a key one. We've mentioned nutrition, but obviously hydration as well, especially for the muscles, and it's quite essential, because I know for myself, you could easily go, I can't remember how many liters of water you're meant to drink a day, or how many cups. It could be 8, it could be 12, I don't know, I've lost track. But you could very easily go into a session dehydrated without you realizing, and then you get halfway through a session, and if you're dehydrated, you're more at risk of an injury. So I would say make sure you drink plenty, like up to three hours, plenty of water in that time frame, not just like down a few just beforehand, because then you're overhydrated. And I've done that in a race. I had to pull over and I had to relieve myself, which was quite embarrassing. But that's just some advice from me anyway, personal experience that I've experienced. Yeah, I was on track for a good time as well. I must have lost about a minute and a half or something. Oh, that's good, but it is what it is. Third clue.
I was going to say, Corey, help me, third clue.
This person is now a television presenter and athletics commentator for the BBC. Do you want to say, go on, Paul, go on.
Is it Steve Cram?
It is Steve Cram. Is his nickname the Jarrow Arrow or something like that?
The Jarrow Arrow, yeah. That's his Twitter handle as well, I think, yeah.
Is it? Oh, yes. Well, that's the end of the podcast, guys. So thanks for being on it. We mentioned quite a lot in a short space of time, so I very much appreciate that as well. So thank you very much, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Cheers.